And as well, the chancellor is under the weather.
Yeah, not well.
And so he will not be here. So with that, are we all here? Do we have a quorum? I think we do. Okay. I call to order the meeting of the UTEMCO Board of Directors. The date is February the 7th, 2017, and the time is now 11:03. Actually, the first item I'd like to compliment you on, Mark, is the ease at which we can now get up to the 28th floor. It doesn't take a Department of Energy security clearance to get up here. So thank you for that more open environment, that more welcoming and hospitable.
I will take credit for it, although I have absolutely no idea who did what, but I'm glad it worked out.
Okay, no, a lot easier.
You know the history behind that.
I do not. What is the history?
So there was a deranged individual that was sending letters to both a few board members and to I think to Bruce.
Okay.
And we had to get the Texas Rangers involved. And they visited this person a couple of times, and based upon his tirades that he had written, and I mean 7-8 page, no spaces, tirades.
So manifestos.
That said, locked and loaded, and I'm ready to act, and all of these things, we decided to lock the floor down out of a precaution. So this is basically, I think, a rolling off of not hearing anything from that guy.
Has left the conference.
I stand corrected. Maybe we need to reinstate.
Well, I was going to say, I think it's a net result of standards slipping all over the place.
So there was a real issue there.
How long ago was that?
That was 2000 and, let's see, between 10 and 11.
Were you that divisive, Kyle, back then?
Well, it wasn't me. I had nothing to do with it.
Wasn't you?
No. Was that person still in the room?
Yeah.
No. No, but the Rangers visited him and scared him to death. And he said, oh, he was just kidding and didn't mean to write it. And next thing you know, a few months later, another letter comes in.
Interesting. So. Okay.
So you've got a lot to look forward to.
I do. More of
so just be careful.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. All right. The first item on the agenda for discussion and appropriate action is the minutes of the December 1st, 2016 minute meeting. Are there any comments or changes to the minutes? If not, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
We have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. The next item on the agenda...
I've joined the conference.
The next item on the agenda relates to the Endowment Operating Funds Report. No action items here. Mark, would you please present tab two for us?
Happy to.
Thank you.
So most of this will look familiar. What I will say is we've reoriented it a little bit and edited it a little bit, and I'm trying to make it much more user-friendly and digestible for you all. First thing I'm going to tell you is we're reporting against our fiscal first quarter.
November 3rd. Has left the conference.
When these board books are prepared, that's the information we had. We don't finalize, for example, December information until late in January. So this is our fiscal first quarter we're going to be reporting against, and we're going to be walking through the entire portfolio sort of in order. So let's just start. Obviously, you guys know how much we're managing these days, $37 billion between all the funds. If you flip to page 3, you can see the performance. What I'll tell you is, you know, the fiscal year's off to a good start. So through November, we were up 177 in the Jeff and 153 in the Puff, and a lot of that was value add. Now, what I'll also tell you is that's very preliminary. Value add will be highly impacted with what happens with the private equity portfolio, as will absolute returns, and as you know, that's very lagged for us. So this is really based on some assumptions around the private equity portfolio and then what we're seeing in the rest of the portfolio that we can easily value. However, those things are all doing well. I can tell you anecdotally, so very unofficial numbers, through January, the endowments look to be up a little less than 4%, and value add is still strong. And so when I see a number between 3 and 4 this early in the fiscal year on an absolute basis, when I see over 100 basis points of value add, it feels like the portfolio is doing well in the current environment. You can see historically, we've always added value relative to policy. I mean, I think that's our job. So we don't expect those numbers, certainly for long periods of time, to show anything different. What I'll also tell you is that, you know, as I've told you before, when you look out the 5- and 7-year period, those are the sorts of numbers that we feel like is the minimum standard that we need to maintain to maintain the endowment's purchasing power. And I've told you guys before, you all, the board, about, you know, we can look at the percentages. I also like to look at dollars. I'll just remind you, on a seven-year basis, we grew the endowment's net of all distributions about $2.3 billion. After inflation, it's about $1.2 billion. So on a seven-year basis, so we have made the distributions and grown the corpus. That's really, really important. We've also done it for 5 years, and it's been about a push for 3 years. And so one of the risks we'll talk about is if we trend below that absolute return line for long, that's when we start worrying about the corpus. And so we'll talk more about that. Going on to the next page, you're all familiar with this. This just shows that on a long-term basis, you know, sort of basic 60-40 mixes of U.S. equities and bonds or global equities and bonds, the portfolio has done better than that. The one thing it hasn't beaten on this display is just a U.S. stock portfolio. And look, equities have done great. And we don't get 100% of the benefits of the equities because we don't have a 100% equity portfolio. But I think you can feel good that on a long-term basis, the portfolio has been compounding at really good rates relative to other mixes. The next slide is, again, one you're familiar with, where we just kind of compare the behavior of the portfolio. It's just one metric we can look at. It's called up-down capture. I think you all are very familiar with this. This really doesn't tend to change very much. But what it tells you is our portfolio, on a risk basis, relative to equities, performs pretty well. We get about 60% of the performance of equities. But during drawdowns, which is equally important, we don't generally suffer as much of a drawdown as the equity markets do. So we get about 60% of the up performance and about 40% of the down. It's not the only metric to look at, but it's just one high-level metric to give you a sense of how to think about the portfolio when equity markets are roaring or when they're pulling back.
Mark, can we see, this is a long-term 20-year chart. Can we look at this on a rolling basis so that we can take a look to see? You're saying it doesn't really change much on the upside-downside capture ratios? I commend you. The downside is terrific. The upside capture, you leave a lot on the table at only 66% in a roaring bull market. But I'd like to see how, if that's being maintained on a 1, 3, 5, 10 in the 20.
Would you like to see it on a rolling basis or on time slices?
Either way you want to do it. But
okay.
I just would like to see if our policy and our asset allocation and our manager selection is improving the upside capture, improving the downside, or the reverse.
I'm happy to do that.
Does it sit right? Would it be appropriate? I mean, we look at 1, 3, 5, 10 slices. Would it be appropriate to, you think, look at it on those tranches? It just seems, I agree with you, 20-year, it's interesting, but,
yeah.
I mean, and what would your opinion be as to if we looked at this thing on a five year basis, what would that update?
My guess is 5 years, Uzi, what do you think? I think it looks about the same. We're probably getting a little more of the ups because it's been an up equity market.
Yes, on strong ups, we're getting a bigger chunk of the ups. On extreme downs, we're getting more on the down. So, yes, on the 5 and 7 years, markets have been way up, and I think we'll be very close to capturing probably 80%, my estimate.
80 of the ups?
80 of the ups on the bull market.
On the last 5 years?
Because there really haven't been any big downs.
Well, and I mean, that would be, you know, great data to look at to show, you know, is the portfolio doing what we are intending it to do? I think great thought.
We're
so
happy to
think,
do that.
Think about those different
times. Sure.
Rolling, you know, whatever it may be.
No problem.
The other reason why that makes a lot of sense is that at least for the, 10, 12 years I've been around, this implies an approach to management which has been explicit,
yes.
You know, to protect against the down at the expense of a little up, but that the trade makes sense in the sense you don't give up as much of the upside as the downside you fail to experience. But this goes back 20 years now, and that may not have been the explicit policy of those mm-hmm. first 10 years. And so you may be mixing regimes in here.
Right, Keith, because you've got different boards. That may not be what this board wants to do. Or maybe
yes.
It wants to be more conservative.
Yeah.
But that's a conservative policy, as evidenced by 20 years of just taking a look at this.
And what I will tell you is, and we'll talk more about this through the presentation, is if there's a little bit of a theme today in how we're positioned, is that we have taken on a little more risk. And so I think we're knowing what we're facing in terms of global headwinds, we're trying to be smart about the risks we're taking on. And we'll talk a bit about that. So I think it's a great point, Ray. Going to the next page, page 6 in the hard copy, what I will tell you is basically this is just trying to lay – this is just the 3 months, so it's just the fiscal first quarter. Basically, everything to the right is a positive absolute value return. So basically, everything to the right of the vertical axis has a positive return. Upper right quadrant is both positive on an absolute basis and positive on a relative basis. And you can just give it the eyeball test. We are adding value, as we talked about, and you can see the portfolio is kind of skewed towards value add, positive return and value add. We just break it up by the individual strategies, and you can see, and their size, the circle is sized according to basically the NAV. And so it's just a quick snapshot of where we're going, but we'll go through each portfolio individually. The next page is just the big number page. It shows the entire portfolio by strategy. We are going to walk down every line of this. That's the way the whole presentation is oriented. And so you can see this has got the fiscal first quarter and then the trailing 1, 3, 5, and 10-year performance and then some portfolio metrics associated with that. The one thing I will point out is we have and going back to this notion of risk, we have a very, very strong Sharpe ratio. A Sharpe ratio over 1 is really, I mean, we've got a professor of finance and portfolio analytics over here can tell us, but I don't know that we can maintain a positive, over 1 Sharpe ratio. But I guess what I'm saying is, maybe to your point, in an up equity market, the portfolio has been doing some very, very positive things. But we think about every risk we add to the book, and is it accretive or dilutive to that? So I'll just introduce broadly. So we'll do MCC first, so our long-oriented public strategies. We'll do the hedge fund portfolio next and then the private equity portfolio next. We'll go strategy by strategy just down this page. I'll just point out to you that for the fiscal first quarter, on an absolute basis, the public book was roughly a push, but it had significant value add. So the benchmark was down. We were flat. On an overall basis, and we'll walk through each one of these strategies, and I'll just ask now that each portfolio manager, starting with Russ, the investment grade fixed income book, walk through their strategy for a minute or so and update the board.
Good. So if you turn to the next page, you've got the MCC investment grade fixed income. Looking at the left-hand side of the page, you see our current NAV and our management mix, which did not change during the quarter. If you go to the right side, you can see our returns. The absolute returns were in line with the benchmark during the quarter, driven down equally by interest rate increases in currency effects after surprise U.S. election results. Our longer-term absolute performance is in line with the portfolio yield, although it's been held back by the extreme outperformance of the U.S. dollar over the past 3 years. Our relative performance over long-term horizons continues to be strong, with information ratios of 0.71. Over the trailing 5 and 7 year periods. Moving on to the next page, we have a characteristics of our investment grade fixed income portfolio. If you go to the upper left hand corner, you see the overview, the yield maturity. We yield 130 basis points more than the global ag, with a duration that is 1.3 years less. And our credit quality is only one step below the benchmark. Go to the lower left-hand corner, our currency exposure. We have a large overweight to the emerging markets, 12%. That's made up of an overweight to Mexico, 4.4%, Norway, 2.5%, South Africa, 2.0%, and Malaysia, 1.8%, among some others that are smaller. This is balanced off by a 9% underweight to the euro and a 5% underweight to the yen, as well as a 3% underweight to the dollar. If you go to the upper right-hand corner, you've got a geographic exposure. Larger weights there. Once again, we're overweight to the emerging markets, 16%, underweight to Europe by 13%, and underweight to Asia-Pacific by 7%. That actually masks an underweight to Japan of almost 16%. Finally, sector exposure. We are overweight to treasuries and corporates, and underweight to government-related and securitized being mainly mortgage securities.
So as you know, we've had some good discussions around this strategy. I think Kyle raised some great points about kind of the macro environment and where this book is positioned. I'd say for the last 5 or 6 weeks, we've really been digging into that since we got back from the new year and really drilling into not just the strategy, but what this portfolio is supposed to do for the endowment. And we had a great working session with Kyle and Lee this morning. I think we're making really good progress. I'll let them share their opinions on that, but I want you to know we are continuing to work on this, and we're going to take 3 or 4 tangible steps in the next week or so to I think, tweak the strategy a little bit to address some of those concerns, and we're still got a couple of work in progress topics on that. Kyle, did you want to share anything?
Sure. Russ and his team and Mark have addressed some of the issues that were brought up. So the issues are basic. They're actually really simple. They are we invest according to a benchmark and create alpha versus the benchmark. The question is, when rates go to zero or even below zero, should we even own any of those securities? We got to a place today where we have 3 action items. One of them is we're going to set forth a policy that basically we're not going to own any securities that have a duration of more than 4 and a yield below zero. And the team is actually going to work a little bit more on, should we own things with a yield of 50 basis points and a duration of 7 when we're trying to deliver 4.75 real to this portfolio, or what the alternative might be in a much lower duration, higher yielding security like a U.S. Treasury. So we're basically questioning the benchmark, right? We're not going to follow the benchmark into the abyss. We're going to make some tweaks to the portfolio so that we don't own what I deem to be some stupid securities.
And
the team's done a great job in coming up with a plan.
Thank you for that, Kyle. I think one of the things we've really discussed internally is I think all those points are valid. The other thing is, though, in reducing duration of this portfolio, which we are recommending we will do modestly, it reduces its diversifying power versus equities. So when equities pull back in some scenarios, long duration or medium duration fixed income tends to be a shock absorber for that. And we've shown during the last 2 big equity drawdowns, this book was up 7% and 9% when equities were down. We don't want to give up too many of those attributes. So we're trying to solve the multivariable equation here of taking some of the risks Kyle's focused on off the table while also maintaining those diversifying effects. And so I can tell you that is not, at least in my mind, was not a very simple, straightforward exercise. It took a lot of thought and stepping back. And we shared with Kyle that one of our largest global macro hedge fund managers, who I think you all might guess who that was, sent part of their research team down here last Friday. And we spent 4 hours going over the policy portfolio and partly this topic. And we're really drilling into it. And I think I want to be really careful that the changes we make don't just address one issue and leave another issue on the table. So we're trying to balance that equation. I feel really good about where the conversation is. I think we made a really good step forward. I really appreciate Kyle bringing the topic to the table, and I appreciate him working with us because we've sat down and had about an hour and a half working session this morning. It takes, you know, more than a couple of minds to sort some of these things. This is a much more complicated portfolio than it might appear on the surface.
Let me just ask one question. Did in the prior drawdowns that you just referred to, did the geographic exposure was it better or worse than if we'd have just strictly had it in U.S. Treasuries?
Ray, the simple answer to you is that you took and simulated what would happen if you took the lowest 30% of the bond portfolio in yield and the highest 70% of the portfolio in yield, right? So we've got 2 pieces now. And simulate what they would have done, or what they did, actually, sorry, not what they would have done, what they did in the global financial crisis and in the other bear market in 2011 related to the euro crisis. The lower yielding securities were negatively correlated to equities. The higher yielding securities were positively correlated to equities in both circumstances. And the reason for that isn't that complex. But your lower yielding securities tend to be the securities that are sovereign and at the highest quality. Your higher yielding securities are going to have negative convexity, meaning they're mortgage securities that have embedded options, right, that work against you. And they would be higher yielding corporates, or they'd be peripheral European countries in this instance. Okay? So more it comes back down to more credit, right? So that's why things work the way they work.
So I'd like to add something to that. So that makes sense back when rates had integers in front of them. Even the low-yielding ones had integers. And what is important is to think about where we are today and not what's happened in the last 10 or 20 or 30 years of a bond bull market. It's, you know, you kind of get to the hard deck of zero and below zero, and the team's really thinking about this. I'll make one comment about what Mark said. Mark said that we're asking, basically our view is that we need to take duration out of the portfolio. That's not the view. The view is you can choose to be as long duration as you want. You can be in 30-year treasuries at a 330 for all we care. We just don't want to own 7-year securities with a yield at 0.10%. It just doesn't make sense.
Totally
understand. So it will reduce duration, but I'm not saying we as a committee and me, we're not saying take duration out of the portfolio. I'm just saying let's not own.
Totally agree. No, Kyle has not said take duration out of the portfolio. What I'm saying is we are dialing duration back just a little bit as part of that exercise, not just because of the issues Kyle's raising, it's because we're trying to balance that hedging effect versus the capital loss potential on some of these scenarios. And so we're trying to balance those two. But Kyle has not been really pushing us in any particular direction other than raising these issues, and we're thinking about them. And so I just, you know, and any board member that wants to understand more about this, we're happy to take it offline. It's a bit esoteric, so I don't know that it's a board table topic, but we're happy to talk about it more. But it's been a great conversation. And what I would just say is it's emblematic of any conversation any of you want to have with us on any of these topics. I think it makes us better, and I think the end product can be an improvement. And I consider this to be kind of an example of the policy portfolio process we want to go through, where we put all these things on the table, and the net result, we hope, is an improved strategy around what we're trying to accomplish.
Agreed. And I would say, look, this is the intellectual interaction that I want, and it's why all of you are on the board, is to provide your unique perspective to what we do as an institution. And so I enjoy the interaction, and I think it pushes you. And where we end up will ultimately be a joint decision, I believe, but you're going to do the work. And so that, just as long as we're talking about this.
Yep.
Real quick, Russ, just for my edification, what is the genesis of UTIMCO running 25% of the fixed income portfolio on an internal basis? How did that, you know, it's a bit of an outlier, obviously, relative to our other strategies. How did that, what's the genesis of that?
Well, long story short, when I started, we ran 100% of it.
Okay.
We realized over time that you want to have really bright people running your bond portfolio, and they're not all in Austin, Texas. And the skill set that our external managers bring, for example, is very valuable. They have great expertise. The reason that we still have an internal book is that, as Uzi would tell you, is it's a marvelous diversifier to our outside manager. And one of the best portfolio, if not the best portfolio that we had in the global financial crisis, was the internal portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So,
it started from a totally internally managed book, and back in the days, the PUF was a total return fund. Mm-hmm. You can only own fixed income.
Right.
So right. Russ goes back to that.
was an income-based fund. It wasn't a total return fund. We paid out all dividends.
Excuse me. We converted it to the total return fund. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why it was structured before the before the legislation in 2000.
99.
Sorry, I was off.
Russ, okay. Can I ask you the external bond managers on performance-based fee?
Largely, they are not. I'd say 90% of our fees that we pay, if not higher, are fixed. You know, we feel like if we pick good managers, we want all that. And we feel like we can do that.
What do you pay for a good fixed income manager these days?
What's the our fees are all between 20 and 30 basis points.
20 and 30?
Yeah.
We only pay Russ and Harlan 15.
If they got better numbers, we ought to go.
We ought to go more back in general again.
Oh, hold on. All right, let's keep going.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, we're not making good time here, but that was an important, I wanted to circle back on that.
Moving on to slide 11 for the MCC real estate update, slide 22 and origin. As of the end of the fiscal quarter, the MCC real estate portfolio had a NAV of $588 million with four partners across five mandates. There were no subscriptions or redemptions during this quarter. Moving on to performance onto the right-hand side, the first quarter of the fiscal year was challenging for real estate securities. A combination of companies lowering guidance and discussion regarding interest rate hikes led to negative returns for the entire sector, and the benchmark returned a negative 9.2%. In this environment, the portfolio also lost value and generated a negative 7.2%. However, it outperformed the benchmark by 200 basis points over the quarter. Over the trailing 12 months, manager overweights to Asia and Europe during the devaluation of the Chinese currency and the Brexit election led the portfolio to generate a negative 2.8% and trail the benchmark by about 4.7%. Over longer time periods of 5 to 7 years, the portfolio has generated absolute returns of approximately 7%. But it's kind of failed to keep pace with the benchmark for a variety of reasons, most of these which have occurred over the last 3 years. This portfolio continues to be sized down and will likely be fully redeemed in the next 3 to 4 months.
So if you remember, we collapsed our MCC kind of specialty strategies into overall just public equity. And so REITs and resources as line items are going away. They're just going to be part of the overall public equity book. That's part of what we did in the policy portfolio this year. So flipping to the next page, you know, I like to have all the portfolio managers speak to these. Billy Prather is in Africa working on a mining investment, and so he asked me to speak to this for him, particularly since it's historically been something I managed. What I will point out to you is...
Can I stop you? Yeah. Why was the underperformance? Why was it 500 basis or almost 500 bips?
Where are we? On real estate?
Page 22.
Page 22?
Or 11.
Real estate page.
Real estate.
Sorry.
Page. Yeah.
So, McKern, you want to speak to that?
Kyle, which one are you referring to? The
1 year? 1 year.
Yeah.
1 year return? Yeah. So, most of our global managers were overweight Asia when the China currency, overweight Hong Kong when the China currency fears happened, regardless of the fact that the Hong Kong US dollar base, it just affected all of the real estate holdings there. And during Brexit, like 90-95% of managers globally, everybody thought that Brexit was a no-go. But and they had overweights in that particular region because the region had sold off into Brexit, and so they had bought value, thinking that they bought value. The election went the wrong way, and they captured most of the downside. Those two events led to the negative 4.7%.
Mark, question with regard to real estate and how we will be looking going forward. Mm-hmm. Love to hear what the staff thinks about interest deductibility and its impact on the valuations of our portfolio.
That's a great question. I don't know that I have a great answer because I don't know where all of that tax policy is going. What I will tell you is, on just a very simple basis, we feel like we can add way more value in private real estate than we can in REITs. And we've just said, the whole reason we own REITs to begin with is when Bruce got here in 2007, we had almost no real estate. You can believe that. And so the idea was, let's get the beta while we build out the private book. Well, fast forward 8 years, we own a pretty good private book now. Might want to make it bigger, but we don't need the beta in the public markets anymore, and we've underperformed. It's just not doing it, you know, not doing us any good. So that was kind of the thinking on that. In terms of the interest deductibility, I don't know that I have a view on that yet. It won't help, right? And so if we know what's going to happen, then we should take action. I don't know what's going to happen. And you guys are closer to tax policy than we are, so anything you can share, you know, we were at a big conference. Kyle was there for a couple hours yesterday. Uzi and I and others were there for a couple days. The biggest issue on the table for all investors right now is we know a lot of things are going to change, but we don't know how. And it's really hard to take action. And the example I could give you is a lot of people question whether they should hedge going into the U.S. election. We didn't. And we and the chancellor specifically asked us at this table, should we hedge? I didn't have a view as to what was going to happen. I certainly didn't have any insights. Had you told me what was going to happen, I don't know that I would have been able to predict what markets would do. As it turns out, not hedging was very beneficial. So, we're hard-pressed to know how to take specific portfolio action against policy.
Specifically with real estate, I would argue that it's definitely worth really thinking through. There will be adjustments, but thinking through that scenario CapEx deductibility, but no interest deductibility.
Yeah, specifically for real estate or for all industries?
Well, for all, but I think it's going to specifically affect.
Well, look, again, you can help us, help us think through those scenarios. I'd love to have that conversation. Flipping to the natural resources page, Billy Prather's not here, so I'll sit in for him. The one thing I think that's the most important thing to know on this page is this is one of the few big tactical things we've done relative to policy. So about a year ago, we redeemed our commodity portfolio almost completely. We still wanted to capture the resource beta. We thought that was important. The diversifying effects from the natural resources sector is important. We moved $300 million out of commodities and into public equities. Over that time, public equities are up 28% and commodities are up 2%. And so, look, we're not timers. We don't always get things right. This was a particularly good decision. It worked out for us. We wanted to continue to keep the exposure to the sector, and this portfolio over the last year has been a big contributor after being a big laggard, as we know, given what was going on in the commodity markets over the previous 2 years. This portfolio, again, will be folded into the overall public equity portfolio. So we'll stop reporting it as a line item next year. But what I will tell you is we're not rushing to liquidate it because we believe there are still macro reasons to own some of these. We are redeeming about a third of the equity portfolio in the near term, and that's mostly the upstream oil and gas sector. We're keeping the services sector, the mining sector, and the MLPs for a while, but we're watching them, and we're watching them in terms of over and underweights relative to our overall public equity benchmark. So Susan and Billy and Amanda are very active on this, and we're going to try to be really smart about how we manage these strategies as we fold them into our public equity book. Susan?
So this next page, as you've seen in prior meetings, the MCC public equity long only, long bias developed country equity portfolio is about $4 billion spread across 14 partners. If you look at the right top box, fiscal year to date, portfolio generated positive absolute returns of 3.4%, exceeding the benchmark, which was flat by that same amount. The drivers of outperformance were a slight overweight to U.S. managers, as well as outperformance pretty much across the board for many of our managers, and in particular from one U.S. manager that is a large weight in our portfolio and that we had added to last year on underperformance. Looking then, the top row across the trailing 1 and 3 year periods, fair absolute performance returning 3.5% and 6.1% annualized respectively. And then over the trailing 5 and 7 year periods, stronger absolute performance of 11 to 13% annualized from a combination of market returns and manager alpha. And then strong relative performance, particularly over longer time periods. In terms of our positioning, the portfolio is overweight technology, consumer discretionary, industrials, and the U.S. dollar. So we'll do well if those sectors and the U.S. dollar do well. And then the portfolio is underweight financials, consumer staples, and most non-U.S. dollar currencies. So euro, yen, Canadian dollar, British pound. So it would be hurt if those sectors and currencies did well.
All on a relative basis.
On a relative basis, correct. The next page is the emerging markets portfolio. Here we have about $3 billion across 19 partners. If you look at the right-hand box, fiscal year to date, the portfolio generated negative 20 basis points of absolute return. It did outperform the MSCI EM benchmark, which was down 3%. The drivers of relative performance were an overweight to countries and regions that outperformed, including the Middle East and Brazil. And then a few of our active managers outperforming their specific markets, including some of our GEM managers, our China manager, and our Korea manager. if you look at the top row there, historical time periods over the trailing one-year period, strong absolute performance of 11% from a combination of market performance of 8.5% and alpha contributing 2.4%. And then over the 3, 5, and 7 year periods, much lower absolute performance ranging from 2.6 to 5.6% annualized. And that was due to weak equity and currency performance offset by strong alpha. In terms of our positioning, the portfolio is overweight consumer, Brazil, the Middle East, and the US dollar. And then underweight financials, technology, Taiwan, South Africa, and Korea.
Susan, is there a quick explanation for why you're overweight tech in the developed markets but underweight in emerging?
In developed markets, a lot of our managers own like the FANG stocks, Google, Facebook, Apple. And then in emerging markets, we do have a fair amount of exposure to tech names in specific markets like China, but other markets like Brazil, India, Russia, like there's not a lot of publicly traded tech, so there's a lot of private tech, and then we have a lot of consumer exposure in those markets. And there's also some classification, like some of the names that you might think of as tech are sometimes classified as consumer.
Great. So now what we'll do, that's the entire walkthrough of the public long-only book. We'll now let Ryan kind of summarize the hedge fund book and then the four strategies that comprise it.
Sure. It was up 1.5% for the quarter, similar to the endowments overall. As we think about our longer-term 5 and 7 year performance of 6.5%, that meets 5 real. That's very close to the overall endowment. We feel like we're meeting our objectives. Also, if you compare it to even MCC portfolios, it compares favorably, except for developed markets. That has been the strongest. Where I look at the 1 year and the 3 year period, it has underperformed. As I look at the 3 years, really 2014, was fine. It was up 4.5. 2015, we were up 1, and 2016, we were up 2. So really, it's the last 2 years, and those are two very different stories. So in 2015, long-short equity, our biggest area, was the only thing that worked. It was up about 6. Everything else was flat to down. So that drugged our performance down to 1. This year, the mirror image. Our three strategies were up between 5 and 15%. Our biggest area, long-short, was down 2.5. So you put that in the blender, and we're down 2 for the calendar year, and we're up 60 bips for the one. Sorry, we were up 2 for the calendar year, and we're up 60 bips for the 1 year ended November. We've added capital to macro, as Drury will talk about, and that had strong returns, and we're sticking with long short. Its alpha generation was negative last year, that Courtney will discuss for a few specific reasons, and it's an anomaly, and we think it's coming back. But that's what's drugged down our returns. And we've made money the last 7 months in a row, and we feel like it's improving, and so we'll just see if it can continue.
So what I appreciate about that summary is the team is very focused on absolute return first. They look at what that's doing for the portfolio, and this is not one big monolithic portfolio. It's really four separate strategies that add up to this overall hedge fund performance, and so the team manages them very distinctly differently. So let's talk about those four strategies individually quickly.
And Ryan, if you did up-down capture, I know you do, but on the hedge fund book, on the LCC, what would that look like relative to the chart that we saw previously?
It's similar overall. Ray and I were discussing that this morning. It's about a 2-to-1 ratio. It's about two-thirds of the up capture, about a third of the down capture. It's a little circular when you look at the endowments because historically the hedge funds were the biggest driver of that. And then also, private equity and then, stocks overall. So, but I think, since inception, we've made money in like 75% of all months. There is some, when we lose money, we do take a hit. We do draw down, but we draw down 10, 20, 25% of what the market draws down. So it's
an equity
capital,
market,
yeah, that capital preservation.
So what would be a typical long bias in your long short? books?
So persistently over time, our beta to equities is 0.3, and our alpha is in that, you know, 4% zip code. And that's by design. We believe, and again, everything's on the table. We're having a great conversation on the policy portfolio. But we believe to generate attractive returns in hedge funds, about two-thirds of the return is from alpha, one-third is from beta. If it were only the alpha, we don't think we could put up the returns that we need.
On an absolute basis.
On an absolute basis. And if the beta were 0.5 or 0.7, that would have helped the last bull market. We think it's hard to time, but we feel like with the risk we take looking at the stock portfolio and the private equity portfolio, we wanted to have a dual objective of the capital preservation, the diversification, as well as the absolute returns. And we can adjust that beta however we want to going forward. That's just how we've thought about it historically.
And Ryan, in 08, 09, you were what, $5 billion in this portfolio?
You're seven at the peak in 07.
Went to
five at the trough.
And yep. Back to 10.4.
Yep.
Is that, how much of that is the additional incremental capital going there, and was that driven by policy?
Let's see, in the 07, 08 timeframe, we were probably around 25 to 27.5% of the portfolio. It peaked around 30. Post-crisis, we stayed there for, I want to say, 3, 4, 5 years. Then it was 27.5. This fiscal year, it's 25. Our base case expectation is it approaches 20 over the next couple of years. You'll see on the capital activity, we redeemed, $380 million net last year, $240 this last quarter. It's going to be a couple hundred million a quarter for the next couple of years.
So great question. To answer your question, Ray, we have been using this as a source, right? Where's it gone? It's gone into equities and private equity. And so we'll talk more about that. And so, again, we think of each one of these decisions as a risk trade-off. And we think of – we build up to how do we get to 5% real. And Ryan sort of encapsulated how we have to think about the whole portfolio. What is beta going to give us? You know, what is the risk premium we're going to get over cash for owning assets? And then what is the outperformance? And it's real simple. The premium on our outperformance is higher. We have to have –
That's interesting. Two-thirds, one-third. So if you don't get two-thirds one value add – it doesn't make sense in the book.
Well, on that rolling five-year chart that you've seen, right. the betas typically contributed between 0 and 4. The average is 1 or 2. Mm-hmm. The alpha, you know, in the heyday, you know, it was 9 or 10. But more recently, it's been, you know, 4, 5, 7. I can count on that 4 alpha. It's less certain on that 1 to 2 beta. You know, it could be 0. And
yes.
So
okay.
That's how we're thinking about the...
On your question, yeah. On the ITF, it moved from 35% in 08 to 45% probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So we on the ITF, the hedge fund is a better fit to what that fund is trying to achieve.
So about $3 billion of the 10 is the ITF.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, okay. What was your?
And I was just going to say, in light of the pressure on fees, can you just address the fees of our hedge fund book?
Yep, it's 1.35 management and 18.7 incentive over the zero line. There's only a few instances where we have an absolute or relative hurdle. So it's the old school model of make money, don't lose money. You overpay in a bull market, but then you're not paying anything in a drawdown, and cumulatively over time, you know, it should net out to 20% of cumulative profits. Alborn is the leader in hedge fund consulting. The average fee of the 550 hedge funds they pulled was, I think, 1.67 management, so about 30 bips higher. And the incentive fee was about a point higher, somewhere in the 19.5 zip code. So we're doing better, but we want to do even better than we're doing now.
And fees is a topic that Jeff brought up, put on the table as we sat down with him to talk about our portfolio policy portfolio process that we're starting much earlier this year. We'll come around and sit with all of you. Fees was one of the things Jeff put on the table. We're going to drill down on. We're going to look at it from a lot of different perspectives. Are there things that could be done efficiently in-house? Are there things we're overpaying for? I can tell you, I believe, you've said this yourself, we have a reputation for pushing on fees. That doesn't mean that solves all the issues. And we also don't want to trade a 25 basis point increase in fees for a 50 bip reduction in performance. You know, we don't want to accomplish one objective and hurt the other. So, but it's a subject we're going to drill into in some detail, and we'll come back to you on for the whole portfolio.
Mark, one thing this underscores, I think, what you were saying earlier, too, is using the hedge fund book as a source of funds to move into equity, and private equity in particular, is you're substantially tilting the risk in the portfolio.
I wouldn't say substantially.
Well, this is an asset class that historically has diversified a lot, mm-hmm. and in some instances even removed risk, you know, on a relative basis.
No question.
And so there is a migration, I guess.
It is. I'm just a little sensitive to substantial.
Yeah.
If you go back 5-7 years, okay. But over the last couple of years, it's been very incremental. But we'll walk you through that. We'll show you exactly what we've done this year.
I was just thinking Ryan's comment about taking this down to 20%.
Well, our feeling is that's possible. Let's be really clear. We're not ready to recommend that yet.
Where are we right now?
The policy is 25 or 26.
We're a little under that. 24. Yeah.
24. So we'll show you the snapshot versus policy here in a few slides.
Okay.
Got it. Okay. Let's go through the individual strategies quickly.
Quickly, I mean, Ryan touched on a lot of the points. Looking at the absolute returns of the long-short book, which was the largest allocation of the portfolio, I think we attribute the underperformance to three things. The first is the most important, and that's negative alpha from stock selection. And that was approximately 5 percentage points in the negative column. That's the worst alpha generation we've seen since 2009. We don't believe that is a sustainable sort of environment relative to kind of what happened last year with a lot of the factor rotations and the fact that our global managers are predominantly people who like to own quality companies. They have a tilt to tech, consumer, healthcare, a little higher growth, structural type, compounding entities, and what we saw is that sort of factor got hurt last year. The second piece is the net exposure was about 36% throughout the year. When you have a low net and the markets rally, it hurts you. It is a drag. And then when you compound the negative alpha with the lower net, and then you gross that up with a higher gross than, call it, the benchmarks, you get sort of a double win. And those three sort of perfect storm occurrences happened last year in our portfolio. We have high conviction that is going to turn around, and we've seen evidence of that in the past 6 months, where our long-short managers are performing better. And we do still believe that the 5-6 or 5-7 year type return expectations are achievable.
How much did we reduce in last year this portfolio with a redemption number? This is year to date, right?
It was flat and long short. It was $720 million came out of multi and events. $400 was added to macro. And a credit was flat and long short was flat. But there's a lot of upgrading beneath the surface.
Great. So
it's been gaining share even though it's
within the portfolio.
Yep.
It's pretty shocking level of negative alpha. Very unusual.
Right.
And so I'm glad you haven't reduced it meaningfully.
Yep. But
just one point. On the specific benchmark, the HFRI equity hedge, that benchmark is traditionally a 0.5 beta or kind of 50% net versus us in the 0.3s. So they're going to perform better in a rising market than we should, than we will. And then they also run on average lower gross. And so the fact that we had negative alpha that was grossed up added to the underperformance relative to the equity hedge benchmark.
Thanks. Multi-strat?
Drury.
Yep. On the multi-strat and event portfolio, it's $2.3 billion across 10 partners, so about 20% of the total LCC portfolio. When we look at the absolute returns over a 5- and 7-year period, we're happy with absolute returns that the multi-strat and event portfolio have delivered. Really, what has underperformed expectations is the trailing 3-year period and 3-year return. That 3-year return has been a result
of one large allocation in the portfolio that we discussed at the last board meeting in the briefing session that is now coming out of the multi-strat and event portfolio, and an overall tough environment for event-driven managers. So as a result of this difficult environment over the last 3 years, we have been reducing the multi-strat and event portfolio, as Ryan mentioned. $700 million came out last fiscal year, and another $150 million approximately this fiscal year. And then recent performance has improved a bit due to improving credit markets and a better environment for value and event equities.
Well, why do you think it's been a bad environment for multi-strat? They have the ability to go anywhere in any different asset class. It's perplexing to me. I'm wondering what do you attribute it to?
Yeah, we look at the last 3 years, and we think that the equity environment has been bad for value-oriented equities, and a lot of our multi-strategies have a very value bent versus where growth equities have typically or have outperformed the value over the last few years. So even though our managers have it can go anywhere, they have that value bent in equity and credit markets.
And with the legal outcomes, the restructuring outcomes, merger arbitrage, it was just they were wrong in their underwriting. Business quality got worse. Judges did things that had never happened in legal precedent. I hate to use the word bad beats, but there were a number.
Yeah.
And there was just kind of no other way to explain
and our
it.
And Treasury Secretary changing.
And, you know, we're confident long short is going to come back. We're sticking with it. We're skeptical this is going to come back, and so we're cutting.
I really saw it start with the Shire merger break, mm-hmm. and then it was
Yep. Thanks.
Ryan, credit?
Yep. We just hired Will Mershak from another firm who's going to help lead credit with me in the future. He'll introduce himself. He'll speak to the LCC and the private credit slides, but he's not here today. It was a strong year for credit. It was up 10.7 for the year ended November, and for calendar 2016, it was up 15. It wasn't just the strong high yield market that was up 18 over this period. It really was 1 and 2 year restructurings and workouts that all hit in kind of November and December and then consistently throughout the year. So we feel like there was a good amount of alpha. It wasn't just the credit spreads, but that, of course, doesn't hurt. We haven't redeemed much capital, but you're going to see us reduce $200 to $300 million this fiscal year as, taking profits after the rally, and the current portfolio doesn't have the setup that it's had the last few years, so we're being disciplined there.
And where do you think that's going to go from a strategy standpoint? Long, short?
Distribution and private equity.
Yeah, fair enough.
So, right, so you're going to reduce the allocation to credit?
Yes, sir.
And why? You just think top of the cycle?
Yep, that's a factor. And then when you get specific through their portfolio, we got paid last year on these specific situations with a handful of managers, and those events worked out. We took the profits. Now you look at what's left, it's just not as compelling. They tend to stay closer to fully invested than we would like. If they would raise 30 or 40% cash, then we'd be fine with that because they could deploy that when spreads widen. So the managers that aren't doing that, we're making the decision for them. And they tend to stretch into kind of levered equity situations late in the cycle, and we're not interested in that exposure. So.
All right, great. Thank you.
And last strategy is macro.
So in the macro portfolio, it's $1.1 billion across four partners, approximately 10% of LCC. Relatively concentrated portfolios. You can see 85% of the NAV really with two large allocations. The story for macro has been that over the last 3 or 5 years, it's been a very difficult environment for all macro managers, not just the LCC macro allocations. And we believe that difficult environment was a result of, frankly, significant central bank intervention, as you can observe through low and negative interest rates and quantitative easing, which resulted in pretty low dispersion across asset classes that our global macro managers trade.
So we spent the last 2 years really reconcentrating the macro portfolio and actually adding capital and sizing it up into this weak performance. So as Ryan mentioned, we added $400 million last fiscal year to our macro portfolio. And even since we struck these NAVs, we've added a little bit more capital. And so over an 18-month period, we'll have doubled the size of the macro portfolio. We're pretty excited about the opportunity set going forward. We think that now that we're in a rising interest rate environment in the U.S. and we're seeing diverging fundamentals across countries, that we're moving into a better environment for macro investing, and the near-term results have borne that out.
Good. Thank you, guys, for that overview of the hedge fund book. So the final portfolio to kind of go through, or asset class, I should say, is the private equity portfolio. The snapshot on page 20 just kind of shows you where we started fiscal year 17, calls, distributions, changes in value, although I would characterize those as preliminary, and then what commitments we've made. You know, private equity is a particularly hard asset class to report on this time of year. We will get the 12/31 marks, which will be a solid set of marks because they're audited financials from all of our partners. We should have them by the board meeting in April, and so we'll be able to give you, I think, a much better feel for where that portfolio is, although we do expect some significant write-ups in a couple of portions of the portfolio at the end of the year. The things I'll draw your attention to, in the middle column there, you see calls and distributions, and you see we've had $550 million of calls and about $300 million of distributions. You know, we've walked Jeff through this a number of times. We model our private equity portfolio on a call and distribution basis every year because we're trying to manage the overall exposure to it. What I can tell you is the distributions have been running below what we expected, and candidly running below where empirically they have historically. You know, on the size portfolio we have, we can expect a certain kind of, you know, annual distribution rate as a rule of thumb. It just hasn't been happening over the last 3 or 4 months in particular. We've had a lot of conversations. I haven't come up with any one really good reason why. A lot of people have said the election, you know, M&A slowed up going into the election. There was a lot of uncertainty. I hear that it's kind of anecdotal. I honestly don't have a good reason right now as we sit here today of why our distributions have slowed up, but I can tell you it's forcing us to take action, and the actions taking is we're slowing up our commitments. We can't allow the NAV of the book to grow and continue to add to that until we get some liquidity from the portfolio. And so over the last 2 months, we've significantly slowed our pace of investing almost to zero in January. I think we literally made $5 million of investments in the private portfolio in January. So this is something we're staying tuned on. We'll talk a little bit more about that in subsequent slides in terms of where the overall portfolio is, but I can assure you it's top of mind for us.
And can Uzi, could you make a comment just because this notion of why the distributions on a historical basis are well below the norm. Any commentary on, is there a structural issue occurring? I mean, I think it's early, so, but I'd love to hear your comments on this, because it's a critical issue, obviously.
So, Mark, we don't know. We've been looking at things that happened in the past. In the past, the distribution slowed when the markets were down. Markets are not down. Kind of it feeling at the top of the cycle, typically you have a lot of, in the past, you had a lot of distributions and capital raise, so it's working differently this time. As we looked at different factors, kind of trying to analyze and learn and put some hypothesis into why it's happening, actually, we still don't know. So that's a big kind of, it's disturbing, because kind of there's something major happening which we still don't have a grasp of what's causing it. At least I don't.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. Ray?
Yeah, Jeff, this is Ray Rothrock. What you observed is very common out here in some of my, you know, cocktail conversations. Because of the volatility in the market, people are really nervous, and so they're being much more conservative with their distributions, having gotten whacked really hard 15 years ago when they over-distributed and had clawbacks. So there's a fair bit of conservatism in some of the bigger funds that I'm aware of. And it's just kind of anecdotal, but that certainly is out there.
Do you think it would be correlated to interest rates moving up so quickly from the Brexit lows?
I don't know. Kind of the typical correlation we had in the past actually is low distributions were went along with low marks, so kind of people were managing to multiple more than this, so kind of if it took longer. So this time we're having good marks with low distribution, so that combination is good. It's something we hadn't had in the past, but kind of it's working in opposite directions of what we're used to.
Mark, how do you explain that when you look at our MCC real estate book, you know, down fiscal year, about 7, the index down almost 10, and our private real estate business is up 2.6 for 2016.
So very preliminary number, Kyle. So what I tell you is what we do is we simply take the most recent mark, which would have been our September 1, and we just adjust it for cash flows.
Okay.
So what we've received from them and the NAV. And so it's a very preliminary number. So like I said, the 12/31 number I think will be a solid audited financial statement from all these, and we can really weigh in on that. So I really don't have a view other than, you know, to the extent it's coming off that September mark, it was probably, you know, hopefully relatively conservatively marked.
And so how much do you think it could move?
I just don't know, Kyle. I mean, I just don't know. We'll see. You know, it's the 12/31 is the single best data point we'll get from our private equity book.
It's about a quarter lag.
Yeah, we'll have it by April. We'll know by April. It's either they either have 90 or 120 days to get their audited.
It's amazing performance, you know, in the private book.
Well, again, I wouldn't even call it performance, right? It's just the last mark adjusted for cash flows.
Got it.
So.
And Mark, I don't want to beat a dead horse on this, but I think it's everyone needs to know. I mean, we need to watch the allocation to this portfolio given distribution issues and lots of different variants. And I know you're doing a very good job on managing that. I just continue to emphasize we need to manage that.
You bet. We get it.
I don't want to wake up in the morning and have a 45% allocation to private equity.
Well, if we do, and the math could turn out that way, it won't be because we kept, you know, we are where we are. Something happened in the market. It won't be because we continue to over-allocate. And look, this is something we've highlighted. It's very short-term in nature. This is really what we've seen over 3 or 4 months, you know, in a 10-year, you know, $10 billion portfolio. So let's wait and see. But I want to give credit to our risk team. Uzi flagged this early. Mm-hmm. We look at it every month. We look at calls and distributions relative to our assumptions. The minute they started to trail under, he was raising the red flag. We socialized it as a team, and we took action.
Yeah, no, look, it's all about being proactive and thoughtful and knowledgeable, and we don't want to be reactive.
Yep.
So just
agreed.
Be proactive in the process.
We will. Thank you.
Right. Can I ask, Uzi, help me a little bit with the private equity situation in light of there's a lot of rhetoric and articles being written right now in regards to a number of items related to private equity. One of those being that the multiples have moved up from 8 to 11 times cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
At 11 times cash flow, historically it would suggest to you that those opportunities to make a decent return are limited. In fact, anything over 10 has kind of been limited. You also are having questions about fees and IRR calculations. You know, whether they're calculating on the minute we commit the capital or when they actually take the capital from us. There are also being discussions about the managers of these private equity organizations are getting vendor favorable allowances that the LPs don't get. Legal fees is a good example that the New York Times just wrote up. Help me kind of walk through that, especially when you take a look at Florida's entire private equity book, and they turned that all over and said, look at what our returns have been over a 15 or 20 year period were abysmal with lots of diversity. Kind of just walk me through as we head and we're growing this private equity book in light of higher valuations, questioning about fees, lower returns, and I know we got $850 billion of capital waiting on private equity to go in. How do we make a lot of money from that? I know that was a lot of questions at once. I'm trying to confuse you.
Yes,
you want
different
to have like 30 have. Seconds? Yeah. Or yeah. Just give me some perspective because we're raising our weights. We're having trouble on our distributions, and we got valuations high, and they're questioning the fees, and the private equity guys in general are saying we can't make the returns.
So a few things. First, we're going through the kind of the policy and the strategy discussion as things going to, in the future is not going to be like the past. I think we have the same kind of arguments almost on any asset class. We're seeing problems or shrinking returns across everywhere. So starting with a fixed income with a zero and negative yields, equities with their multiple and all-time highs. So we're seeing, I think everything is compressing, but relative, I still think that privates are in a better place than publics, not the way they were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years. So the expectations in my mind of all asset classes are shrinking, but the basic model that privates have is buy, let's call it, buy at the public markets, add value, and sell at the park. So they're exposed to the public markets, but I don't think that the future is as bright as the past, but still brighter than public markets. That's kind of the simplistic view.
So, Ray, one thing I want to say, we're not growing this portfolio. We're essentially maintaining it now. What I've told Chairman Hildebrand, and I think what I've told the board, is kind of 40 is our number. Our limit is 45. We're managing to 40. That's a little ahead of policy, but we're not growing it at this point. We think of it as maintaining and optimizing at this point. Now, it's still a big allocation. Let's don't kid ourselves. What I'd like to do is maybe take this a little bit offline with you, because I think these are all great questions, and walk you through the individual strategies, because we don't think about it as, like we did the hedge fund book, as one big monolithic allocation. It's a bunch of individual strategies. We're not in any of the big buyouts, for example, where you would say many of the sins that you mentioned are prevalent. We're not in that. So that's one really clear step we've made. So let's take some of those in mind as we move forward. Page 21 just shows you the historical returns for each of the six strategies that make up the overall private equity book versus their most relevant part of our fund-to-funds benchmark. Now, as some of you know, credit, real estate, natural resources are not represented in our fund-to-funds benchmark, so I can't spread the numbers versus those. But what you can see in the total line is how we've done versus the fund-to-funds benchmark by adding all those together. And you can see on a one-year basis, and these are all the fiscal year numbers that you've already seen. So we've added value relative to the fund-to-funds benchmark in all time periods. Unfortunately, I can't do a lot of intra-portfolio attribution because of the way that benchmark is constructed. So if you want to turn to the next page, this is actually a slide you all haven't seen before. And by the way, we'll go through each one of those individually, so I think it'll be more instructive. The next page, what we've done is we've gone back, we've looked at the last 5 years of our actual exits, so the cash we receive when we sell a private equity position. Because one of the things we've heard from the board is, well, we're not sure these marks are real, and I think that's fair. The marks are somewhat in our partner's discretion, although at year end, their accountants get to weigh in on the reasonableness of those. But we wanted to kind of back test our actual data and see how did we perform relative to the marks. What I'll direct you to is the top section, looked all the way to the right, where you see the total. So what we did was from each realization we had, and I think there was 1,500 realizations, and we analyzed, I think, 1,200 of them. We picked the bigger ones. We looked back 1 2/4 from when we actually received the money and said, how did our partners value that, the ownership of that company before they sold it? The light blue bar is looking back 1/4. So what that's saying is on our overall private equity book, 1/4 before we sold a position, the net realization was 20% better than where they had it marked. The total, looking back 2/4, so 6 months before they sold the company, was more like 40%. I thought that was really interesting. I mean, what that's telling us is, on average, statistically, not every single one, we are getting better than where our book is marked. That meant something to me, and this is based on a lot of data. So this isn't, you know, any sort of.
Yeah. Although you're not counting the ones that weren't realized, right?
Right. So well, I mean, we can only do a realization.
Ones we sold.
Right. These are actual realizations. So the top is the simple average. The bottom is the weighted average. So not taking a small position that got a big write-up and letting it contribute too much, but really looking at the actual dollars on a weighted average basis. Still, on a 1/4 basis, it's about 13% better. On a 6-month basis, it's about 30% better. So where I think the board can take comfort is, even if we're not getting the realizations, the value is in the portfolio. I do believe that. Can things change? You bet you. Can we trend below these numbers? You bet we can. So we update this every quarter now based on actual realization.
This is a great work.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
gives everyone around this table a lot of solace that marks are
so it in some ways addresses some of the questions you asked about how are we going to make the returns. This is an IRR, but it's telling you the value that we've got in the book means something. So I think when we get those 1231 marks, and we talk to you about them in April, it'll mean something.
Mark, it would be interesting if there have been 1,500 realizations, how many are unrealized, and what have those marks done during the same time period?
So did parts of the book get written down that weren't realized?
Yes.
Okay.
And they often don't get written down, but it's that rump that, you know, you never recognize in the private equity portfolios, or often don't.
Right. Well, I wouldn't.
Until it's.
Right. So there's unquestionably some part of the private equity portfolio gets written down, and the realization is less than where they had it marked. That's baked into this. And to the extent there was a realization that was less than it was marked, that's baked into these numbers. Yeah. These aren't just the cherry-picked ones that work. This is everything. This is everything.
Did the data surprise you?
I was surprised at the magnitude. And that's why we went back two quarters, is typically these M&A processes can take 6 to 9 months. And so what we wanted to see was, were people writing it up, expecting an outcome, getting an outcome that was less? That's the behavior I was looking for. And we haven't seen that.
This is over what period of time?
About, I think, 5 years. So going back to fiscal 2011.
What do you think that, just in terms of the absolute numbers of realizations would be?
It was over 1,000. Zoe, do you remember? Okay. It was, I'm going to say it was 1,000 or 1,100. We can get you the number.
Interesting to see. And the size, was it $3 billion, $500 million?
Okay.
What was the size of the realization?
Okay. We'll get you. Anson? Is Anson in here?
Yep.
Do you know those numbers off the top of your head?
Okay.
Okay. That's an easy thing to answer.
Anyway, very nice work here.
That's good. So let's quickly go through the private equity strategy, starting with credit. Ryan?
Sure. We're allocating only $75 million of new commitments to this area this year, and it's with a partner that we, seeded. And, 5% for the fiscal quarter. This book is half of the size it was, in 2009. So at the peak, credit was 17% of the endowments, 7.5% private credit, 7.5% LCC credit. And so we're going to keep monetizing this portfolio, and the bar is very high on any locked up capital in this area.
Same top of the cycle notion, you believe?
Yeah, but even more, I wish it were as liquid, but we still have good stuff in the portfolio. And the bar to compete with private equity dollars for new unfundeds going forward, the bar is very high.
This is locked up capital. Yeah. It's even higher than in the hedge fund.
Yeah, book. It's that same 4 or 5 year duration kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So,
but the returns have been very nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, but going forward, take it.
Yeah,
exactly. You'll take it. Stop there, Mark. Trust me.
There aren't many of those around here, Ryan.
Take that one home.
No, they've been outstanding. Very nice.
All right, real estate, McCunn.
On to private real estate. As of the end of the fiscal quarter, the portfolio had a NAV of $1.8 billion across 24 partners. The NAV is concentrated mostly in North America and Europe, and we do have a little bit of exposure to Asia and Latin America. Capital movement over the quarter included about $101 million for drawn by the managers for new investments, and they distributed distributed $73 million for a net outflow of $28 million out of the portfolio. For the fiscal quarter, the portfolio did generate positive absolute returns, but as Mark mentioned, still preliminary. We'll wait to see what the year-end marks are. Over longer time horizons, the portfolio has generated between 10.5% and 17.4% returns, and generally beaten the private equity fund of funds benchmark as well as its specific Cambridge Associates opportunistic real estate benchmark. Our outlook for this sector is cautious. We believe that real estate markets are fairly valued. There's limited upside going forward. So in the U.S., we are focused on adding exposure through sectors that have very attractive demand characteristics, such as, say, senior living or need-based Class B apartments or needs-based consumer retail like grocery and food retail and such. To further reduce the risk profile of this portfolio, we are paying a lot more attention to the interim cash flows that these investments generate during the whole period. In Europe, the focus is more on accessing distress in Spain, Italy, France, and trying to access some post-Brexit UK properties as investors are unloading those.
We think this portfolio has been performing well as well. We understand where we are in the real estate cycle and in the interest rate cycle, so we're mindful of that. These guys are very targeted in their investments, a lot of really specialized strategies. And obviously, it's got characteristics of cash flow and distributions that I think are the kind of things owning going forward, I think, may be more valuable than in a market where equities are up. And so it's one of the things we're thinking about, is what's the right allocation to real estate for us going forward.
Would you say, I mean, say over the last, I mean, once again, good outstanding returns, but was a lot of that return generated via monetizations? It have to be, right?
In terms of capital returns,
yeah,
yes,
right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You bet.
So your partners are...
Cap rates have been coming down. Mm-hmm. We don't think they're going to go down much further.
But they cycle through their portfolios pretty routinely, right?
Yes, they have. A lot of these returns actually are coming from distributions from our portfolios.
Right.
We have seen them.
And is the typical hold for most of our partners kind of this 3 to 5 year time frame?
In the past 3 years, it has been closer to the 3 years. Over long term, we expect 5 years and so more than 5 years. But 3 years has been kind of the norm, starting from 11 to.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Flipping to the resources slide, I'll also pinch hit for Billy on this one. Look, what I can tell you is we're feeling really good about where this portfolio is positioned. I wouldn't pay too much attention to that 6% number because that's preliminary, so we'll see where the marks come out, although we feel like the marks are going to be pretty positive in this portfolio year end. Look, it's $3 billion that's compounded at 15% over the last 3 years, including a pretty historic commodity correction. So we feel really good about the absolute return based on all that. I think that number will come up based on what's going to happen in this portfolio at the year-end marks. As well, last year and the year before, we did both years about $300 plus million in direct co-invest with no carry, no fee, at a great point in the cycle with our partners. So I think that $700-800 million is going to pay really good dividends over the next 3 to 5 years in that portfolio. So I think we feel very, very good about where this is positioned. I think the two places we're really digging in on that we've begun to allocate to, the energy book's been doing great. The infrastructure book, which is largely power development in emerging markets, has been doing great. The mining book has been a little bit of a headwind, and mining's been just decimated, as we know, over the past several years. We're really re-underwriting that portfolio, and the agriculture portfolio we're really, really optimistic about, but it's early. It's early, and so we'll see where that goes. But overall, we're very opportunistic about that portfolio in the current
Mark,
environment.
Mark, you know, I know we from time to time have talked about correlation between this book and West Texas Lands,
mm-hmm.
and I know you've done some work on this before, but how much of the 39% upstream and 7% midstream, how much of that do you think is influenced by what's going on in the Permian Basin?
Very little.
Very little.
We have, I can't remember the number, but of that portfolio, it's 10-15% tops.
Okay.
We're much more international than most people. So as you know,
right,
a big part of our energy portfolio is in Canada and elsewhere in the world, not in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That's really uncommon in the institutional space. So, mm-hmm. So relative to that geographic metric, we're actually pretty diversified.
Mm-hmm.
Many we own some assets in the North Sea, for example. The drivers in the North Sea are much different than West Texas. So we think we're going to realize some outcomes there that don't reflect the Permian Basin.
Okay.
Susan, the venture capital portfolio?
Yeah, the venture capital portfolio is about $1.3 billion of NAV with another $750 million unfunded across 32 partners. Two-thirds of the portfolio is technology, 10% is life sciences, and the rest is a mix. Fiscal year-to-date through November, positive return of 3.3%. Again, it's a preliminary number. Looking across the first row, last year the portfolio had a negative absolute return of 8.4%, and that was following a very strong return. I think you guys may remember, a strong return of 50-plus percent in fiscal 2015. Over longer periods, the portfolio has generated strong absolute returns of 20 to 25% over 3 to 7 year period, driven by a combination of asset class returns, and you can see that in the specific benchmark row, that's the venture index, as well as manager alpha. In terms of positioning, our partners continue to be pretty cautious about deploying capital given the valuation environment, and so we're focusing on maintaining and growing our core relationships and letting non-core relationships roll off.
So just quickly addressing staffing here, you know, this is the one area. We've made some great hires. We're going to talk about them a little bit later in the organizational update. The one place that we lack the talent that we want to have is in the venture space to work with Susan. And so Ray Rothbach has been super helpful in us both thinking about our strategy and thinking about how to add to the team. Susan's been working really hard. We are in a couple of conversations that may lead us somewhere. So I will just tell you, this is a part of the portfolio that we really want to focus in on the strategy. Do we do more venture? That's where other people have been before. I don't know that we want to do more venture. It's certainly been accretive to the portfolio historically. We really want to kind of figure that out. And I think in part to do that, Susan needs help. She took on this portfolio essentially by herself. So it's an area of the organization that we're focused
Susan,
on.
What's your perspective, just how crowded the sector is, you know, given all the other alternative spaces that are very crowded? Mm-hmm. What do you think about venture?
Venture definitely seems very crowded. There are a lot of new funds. I don't know that it's more crowded than private equity. I think like private equity, what really matters is that we can have access to the best funds. And we have some things working for us, like Ray contributing on the board, as well as our size in some cases and ability to sponsor new managers and get capacity with them early. And some things working against us, being a public institution. You know, I think it's similar to private equity in terms of the opportunity.
The lower middle market private equity book, who's Todd? Oh, good. Pat. I hadn't seen you this morning. I'm glad you're here.
Good to see you, too. I'm going to cover both the lower middle market private equity as well as the general private equity book. So lower middle market is where we focus when we do new sourcing. It's about $933 million of NAV across 21 partners. I'd say 13 of those are considered core or strategic. Over the first quarter, the portfolio returned 1.4%. And as of August 31st, the one-year return was 58.3%. And if you look at that and then look at the longer-term time horizons, we've significantly outperformed both the general and the specific benchmark. This is a book that's not yet mature, so it is one part of the private portfolio where I do expect calls to outpace distributions, at least for the next couple of years until it matures. But also, just in terms of outlook, we look a lot at acquisition multiples, and we have seen multiples rise pretty significantly over the last couple of years. We've seen record amounts of fundraising, and we see, frankly, record amounts of dry powder in the private equity space. So we're cognizant of that. We think about that as we source. We also think we're well-positioned because the part of the market where we focus is actually underneath that technical. So the lower middle market space really hasn't seen the same dry powder and fundraising tilt that the middle market and mega spaces have seen. And I think also, should those trends continue, those are the partners that will be looking to buy our companies. So if it continues, we think we're also well positioned from an exit perspective.
So one thing about this book. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ray.
I just have a question. On the second bullet under the box in the lower right, the one-year return,
yep.
Would it be appropriate to separate out the funds versus the direct co-investments so we can see that relationship?
Well, we have a co-investment slide on the next on a couple of pages subsequent to this, so let's take a look at that and see if that addresses your question. What I will say is I think the board may remember we have one very large concentrated position in this portfolio. It's a meaningful amount of what's happened in this portfolio. We can't talk about it in an open meeting. We did talk about it in executive session a couple of meetings ago. We don't have a substantive update to share with you right now on where that is, but we will, and we're obviously staying very close to it because it's going to have a big impact not just on this but on the overall endowment portfolio.
That's right, and happy to take any questions offline on that concentrated position as well. For the general private equity book, so this is a book we, with the exception of a couple of core managers that are actually more in the technology vertical that would be in our growth portfolio, is also refers generally in runoff mode. So this is about $1.1 billion in NAV. Most of these partners were underwritten, I'd say from a time frame perspective, pre-financial crisis. This portfolio returned 2.7% in the first quarter. The one-year mark of 2.3% did underperform the benchmarks, but if you look at the longer-term time horizons, this portfolio has generally returned 8 to 10%. And sort of talking to all of these partners and thinking about, you know, they're all basically looking to take advantage of the current market technicals and exit. So they're all in pretty active exit mode. So we do expect this portfolio to continue to return 8 to 10% as we sort of wind this down.
So that's really the legacy part of our portfolio, Ray, that had some of the sins that you talked about. This is just in runoff mode. We're not contributing any new money to it. That's kind of why we break it out separately. If we were going to reduce our private equity book on a manual basis, i.e., if we were going to sell something, it would probably come from this.
What do you define as lower middle market? What's the?
Yeah, it's a good question. We don't have a precise definition for it.
We generally think EBITDA under $25 million. I mean, we look for funds that underwrite $5 to $15 million, but we think under 25 is that bandwidth. And then from a fund size, under generally anything under $400 million for fund size.
I mean, so why do you reduce your allocation to it? I mean, your returns have been spectacular.
We're not reducing our allocation.
You're not.
No.
Okay.
No.
We're letting the stuff that doesn't fit those characteristics run off.
That's this part.
Okay. We're also trying to actively manage where we are on the overall side of the market. Look for new managers.
Kyle had a question.
Back to Ray Rothrock's question.
Yeah.
If you just, congratulations, though, on the one outlier.
Well, let's wait until we get it. But
if you take the outlier out, what are the 1, 3, 5, and 7?
So I think we'll do that. I think you'll see more J-curve because these are relatively new funds.
Okay.
Yeah. But we'll do that. We'll try to separate that out. Okay, emerging markets, Richard?
So on the emerging markets portfolio, again, the NAV around $1.2 billion, 22 managers representing just around 4% of the PUF and GEF, or around 11% of the private equity portfolio. For fiscal year 2016, they returned around 5.2% positive return. Contributors to that were primarily from our Asian partners, particularly technology strategies, as well as our EM co-investment activity, which we have three as of the most recent fiscal year. Compared to benchmarks, the portfolios generally tracked the general specific benchmarks over a one-year horizon, but lagged over longer periods of time, primarily related to A, a young portfolio, B, the fact that before the creation of a dedicated EM team, which was around 2 years ago, 90% of NAV was put into place back then without as much of a, again, cohesive dedicated strategy. Over the past 5 to 6 years, the U.S. dollar has been on an incredible bull run, so FX has been a significant headwind to the portfolio. We maintain a positive outlook as the EM portfolio matures and benefits from, I would say, overall attractive growth and value dynamics, which is sort of the earlier comment on valuations. Our core managers, I would say, are acquiring today companies around 5 to 7 or so, even not multiple-wise, not the 10s or 11s that you see in developed markets. So we see really interesting value attributes there. And the fact that we just brought on, and I think you guys are going to touch on this later, a dedicated EM Asia coverage person in Sunil Kaji this past September. So our go-forward focus to improve EM private performance will be to make gradual structural adjustments in geographic weights, particularly in Asia and LATAM, so from a top-down perspective. And from a bottom-up perspective, deepen local partnerships, improve manager selection, and build a strong co-investment portfolio.
So one of the things we've done, Ray, to address some of your concerns is, look, we see the funds. They come through here. We saw the growth in private equity, particularly in the U.S. One of the things we tried to do was go elsewhere, right? We went to emerging markets, a lot less private equity there. We felt like being early there and working with talented people might give us an edge. Look, EM's had a lot of headwinds. Obviously, FX, I would say we paid a little bit for our learning curve. And what we did 5, 6, 7 years ago, we didn't have a dedicated team. We now do. We have Richard. You met Sunil at the last board meeting. Two really impressive guys that are really spending much more time
here. So the idea is we need to make this work for us. We need to make this be a diversifier and to work for us. And so we're very focused on that. The next page, page 30,
Mark,
just...
You guys break the Asia down between like China, Japan, other, what percentage is... it's such a huge portion of the book. What? Help me out. Help me understand where it is.
China specifically?
No, just how is Asia broken out?
Asia's broken out. So China and India, Southeast Asia are going to be three main hubs of that. The specific numbers around China, around that breakdown, it's heavy. It's heavily skewed towards China. 50-60% or so of that Asia bucket is China. The rest is pretty much, I would say, evenly split between India and Indonesia heavy, a little Singapore.
China and the rest. Mm-hmm.
And China's heavily, heavily technology, so venture-focused.
Some of that is coming actually from Susan's relationships. Right? Okay, so looking at the next page, this is our co-investment summary. Ray, this will speak a little bit to your question, although we need to, we'll be responsive to you in breaking out the lower middle market so you can see the just the fund performance, but we continue to make co-investments. You know, the co-investments right now are a particularly hard decision for us because it's immediate. It immediately goes into the portfolio. So in a situation where our NAV has grown from marks and a lack of distributions, committing to a fund really affects the portfolio 2-3 years from now. Committing to a co-invest, that money typically goes in the ground right now. However, they're some of our best investments. And so there's a real tension there for us, which is why we're having to be really, really careful. But what I will tell you is I think the co-investment strategy is working. I think it's still relatively early. We've had a handful of exits, not as many as we've liked. Those exits have been good. So it's compounding at where we would expect it to. We believe it's some of the best ideas our partners bring to us. And the other thing we have is we have the team. We have a Richard, we have a Sunil, we have a Billy, we have a Pat. We have guys with deep expertise to interface with our partners to make these investments. So I think this is a real, real core competency for the endowments going forward. And we'll continue to show you kind of each quarter how we add to this portfolio and what it's doing. And I hope in the next two or three quarters to be able to talk about some more realization. So that's really performance. Let me pause before we go into the risk section. We've had some good discussions. Are there any other questions around performance or any of the portfolios that we've broken down? If there's not, we'll try to quickly move through the risk section. I think that's the only thing standing between you and lunch. On page 31, you know, you guys are familiar with our risk dashboard. What we do is we think deeply about each one of these risks, and we try to flag for you where we think the risks are. This is totally subjective. This is our judgment, primarily Uzi's, but also mine and the rest of the senior team. So I want to flag, it is subjective. However, it's subjective based on some analysis and some criteria, but we try to be really, really transparent about where we think you should be concerned. Underperformance has been getting yellower and yellower as we look at recent returns that, while maybe positive relative to the market, are not meeting our long-term absolute threshold. I would say underperformance is related to some of the other risks we're flagging. Scenarios, downside volatility. Not so much illiquidity, because we think we're taking on healthy illiquidity, but I think underperformance is the net risk result of some of these other risks. And so let me let Uzi walk you through some of these, and three or four of them we'll walk through specifically.
I think we want to concentrate on kind of the ones that have a bit more red here, which would be the scenario downside, volatility, and illiquidity. I think there's a growing tension now between what we'd call scenarios and volatility. A lot of things can go wrong in the world, which is the scenarios. Volatility is surprisingly low in the markets. So that's a mismatch which at least I don't fully understand. Many people don't understand, but definitely we want to look at the low VIX is not an indication of the things that could go wrong, and we are concentrated on scenarios. The other one is the illiquidity. So if we're skipping to where we are on risk and return, which is slide 33, 44 on diligence.
This is a new slide y'all haven't seen before. I worked with Uzi to develop this, just a simple snapshot to kind of show you one of the risk metrics, one of the ways to kind of portray the risk in the portfolio.
Based on, so this is trying to be forward-looking. So based on our asset allocation, our actions, and our policy, we for each asset class, we have kind of the expected volatility, risk, and return. We have two lines here. One is how the policy is evolving, which is in the circles from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. We said we'd implement it basically gradually, 25% each quarter. So we moved from the first circle to the red circle, and by the year end we'll be at the orange circle. The actual we've been ahead of. We started the year already with higher allocation to private routes, which moves the expected higher and the expected volatility or risk higher, but not as much. So it's still up and to the left of kind of the bottom line. And the red square is where we are now. We're very close to where we want to be at the end of the year. So kind of in a way, we're ahead of plan, but not very far from where we want to be at the end of the year.
So these circles represent 25 basis points of just risk and return. The dotted circle and the solid circle. It's just kind of give you a bullseye. And the point is, those four dots, the purple, the red, the blue, the orange, are policy as it vests during the year. You remember when you agreed to a policy, we made it effective the end of the fiscal year, and we vest it every month. And so this is just showing policy as it will evolve through the fiscal year. So the center of the bullseye is year end, the fiscal year end target risk and return. The red square is where we are now. And so the point is, we're a little bit ahead of policy. We know that. We know that. We want to keep articulating that to you as well as we can. We're 400 basis points over privates from where policy is. That's how that square shows up. Okay? So we understand that. We'll show you the actual over and underweights versus all the policy in a couple of slides, but I just want to highlight to you that's, you know, we're not just thinking about that in terms of absolutely where are we today, but where are we relative where policy will be at the end of the year.
I've got a question for you. So going back one page, we look at the scenario analyses. How often are you kind of socializing these ideas with our one client board of regents system? And how often are you discussing kind of what's going on geopolitically with potential probabilities of these outcomes? Is the client okay with being down 22% or not? Or how many of those conversations are you having with them?
So the primary place I do that is when I meet with the regents that are on our board. So do I meet with the other regents outside of that? Generally not.
Okay.
We're making a brief presentation in the finance committee meeting, I think, tomorrow. Let me make it clear. Anytime anybody at the system or any regent or any board member wants to talk about that, we need to be prepared to talk about that. So if there's a better way or we should do it more often, we are totally open to that.
Yeah, Mark, one of the things I think that's important, your endowment risk dashboard, it is subjective, and I think there's a lot going on the page. It's in many ways kind of overwhelming, but I get it. But one of the things I think that's really important for the region, for the client, for the system employees, is this idea of trend analysis. What's this portfolio over the last 5 years, 10 years? How are we moving the portfolio away from public equities and fixed income or 100% fixed income? And what's the risk associated with that? The up-down capture, the vol, however we capture that, but this notion, and the A&M regions too, is what are we doing to the composition of this portfolio over time, and are they all willing to get on board with that?
Mm-hmm.
And showing how vol will have increased probably pretty substantially relative to what it was 5 years ago or whatever it may be. I think this idea, because we take snapshots and we think that's the way the world's always worked. Well, the world's not worked that way. It's a very different portfolio. Mm-hmm. So I would really like to see some work done as to the portfolio over time. And so the A&M regions, the UT regions, the chancellor, we can sit down and say, okay, this is what's happening to the portfolio, okay? And just so everyone's on board with that, because we do. I mean, you know, a 22% downside to the corpus would, you know, there'd be no one that's happy about that, obviously.
Right, and look, we've all lived, you know, most everybody on the senior staff's lived through one of those. And so the reality is it could happen. It could happen to this portfolio. It could happen to the portfolio of 5 years ago. I understand your point about kind of where has risk and allocations gone over the last 5 years, so we can absolutely do that. One of the ways to look at that is the next couple pages. You can just see our relative risk. And, you know, one of the things you and I have talked about is when we took risk off and how expensive that was. If you all look at on page 34, when we took a substantial amount of risk out of the portfolio in calendar year 11, markets outperformed. And taking that risk off really hurt. And so we look at it from both perspectives, you know, what we missed or what happened to us. But Uzi, you want to address, this is the downside volatility relative to policy.
Yes. Slide 34 is downside volatility relative to policy, and slide 35 is more in absolute terms. Relative to policy, we're at a higher level, very high level, as of November. December, this number started coming down. Part of the reason of being high is, again, being just ahead of policy. As you said, kind of the policy is a risk increaser as we are moving more into private, and we're already at the higher level of private investment. So as policy, in a way, catches up, we expect this number to start coming down. But on a relative basis, this is a high number, and it's a tension between the desire to capture the risk and returns and the market conditions, which are kind of feeling kind of rich or top of the cycle, late inning. So it's a tension, and there's thoughts on both sides, dry powder versus excess risk. On the next, on relative basis, and that goes actual volatility, which captures both what the market is doing and how the portfolio and the policy changed over time. These times right now look surprisingly normal. So kind of the green line, which is our actual, is a bit ahead of the blue line, which is policy. But where we are now is one of the lower points in terms of actual volatility. So again, it's surprisingly normal given what's happening in the world, and that's why we want to look both at kind of these measures and other measures of risk.
So that's relative. This is absolute. Mm-hmm. So they look quite different.
Yeah.
And so we think about them both. And when I think of risk, I think of what kind of risk are we adding? And we'll talk a little bit about that. I don't think risk is a little bit amorphous. What risk are you adding? And we'll talk a little bit about that. When we make these relative risk trades, that's really important. And the net result is we want to add smart risk. We think we have to. If you tell us we have to make an absolute return, we look at what the market's giving us. We look at what we're going to get from beta and how much alpha we have to add. And if we're below risk, we're not going to hit your return. Now, I will tell you, every asset manager in the world is thinking that. Mm. We're not the only ones. And so if everybody rushes to add risk, it can have some really bad outcomes and some bad scenarios. The question is, at least on the margin, what risks are we adding? And so we'll talk a little bit about that.
Can I add something, Matt? Back to Chairman Hildebrand's point on proactivity. When I look at the risk dashboard, if I were the client, what I would like to know, the staff is an amazing staff here. What I would like to see here is these are scenario analyses that Uzi painstakingly put together, but the probability of each one of these, as per the staff's, let's say, a best guess or subjectivity, changes over time. We have a new president, we have new trade reps, we have new things going on. I think something that would be really interesting to add to this would just be one column, staff's mm-hmm. probability weight of happening. Mm-hmm. Then you could start tracking the change, and that also might have to help the staff think about hedging or not hedging. Mm-hmm. It also helped the client understand what the staff's perception of that risk could be, instead of just saying, these are potential risks, here's what would happen. Mm-hmm. Think, these are the probabilities of these risks happening, and this is what we are doing about it, or that we're not doing about it. Mm-hmm. And if I were the client, I'd love to see that. And that would just be kind of polling the staff.
That's interesting.
Okay. I'm thinking to myself, how to be really thoughtful and responsive to that, and we will do that.
Keith, do you have any ideas on
on this notion of risk return. And I mean, these guys do a great job, I think, on putting the data together. But this condensation of kind of where we've been and where we're going, and just so everyone's got this very transparent view of it. And I know it's a complex subject matter and hard to put on one slide, but I would ask you to maybe think about that as well. I mean, just from a, you know, what you've seen academically is what's out there. Okay. Any comments?
Well, now? The dashboard, I think, was an attempt to try to capture what is really a multifaceted problem. I mean, the desire would be to come up with the magic bullet number, and I don't think you're going to get them. You know, there are different ways of thinking about risk. You know, the best definition that I've ever heard is one of my colleagues in London said that, you know, risk is that more things can happen than will happen. And so how do you capture that in a single number? I don't think you're going to get there. And so the question is really, how do you want to convey that information? I like the idea of thinking about the, you know, and Ray had brought this up in an earlier context, is kind of thinking about the migration of this over time, and are you comfortable with where this is going? I like the focus on downside measures of risk as opposed to, you know, sort of a more generic volatility
right.
measure. I think that's appropriate. I think that's appropriate in the context of running an endowment. So, I mean, that's kind of a long-winded answer.
Look, you guys have done a tremendous amount of work on this over time. And just, I would, you know, let's look at this anew a bit. I think
sure.
to give, because at the end of the day, I mean, Kyle says it, the client needs to have total transparency and feel comfortable about this. And you've got to be able to convey the data to them.
Agreed.
You know, quickly.
So let me see if I can capture the intent. And that really is the client needs to know what could happen.
That's right. Yes, yes.
We understand that.
Okay, got it.
We'll do our best on that.
Okay.
And
realizing that you won't get the right clients. Crisis.
No, of course we won't. Of course we won't.
Not a chance.
But the point is, we need the clients to understand what could happen. I think that's as clear as we can be.
I think his point a little bit different. Kyle's point was, it's not just what might happen, mm-hmm. but the probability.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Understood. Look. Whatever we come up with will be wrong. Let me just be clear. Nobody knows. Okay? But we can try to be very reasonable about it. And it give you ranges, is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, because I was here in that 2011 meeting you were referring to, and it was caused, I mean, that was the client having a point of view which caused a reaction by Utimco, which really hurt us. And so I think we need to balance those things and not get too, too cautious.
Yeah, look, we're not throwing this thing in forward and, you know, slamming on the brakes and putting in reverse. I mean, this is endowment. I mean, we're going to run this thing in perpetuity. So, but this is just how is it kind of, what's the trend of all of this?
Understood.
So, to be proactive in the process.
Mm-hmm. All right, understood.
Great. Thank you.
And that was a Regent decision in 11.
No, we had the chairman
of the board of regents sat right there.
Yeah, and he had a very strong opinion that we shouldn't have any risk, and it resulted in some other things
we
happening.
We hedged, and markets went up. Yeah. Mm. And so I don't know that the clients really...
He's not a professional, and I don't think the clients were very well served by that action. Yeah.
And I don't think that's what's being suggested here at all, but I think the point is the client needs to know what the ranges of outcomes are as clearly as we can state it.
Mm-hmm. On consequence, so obviously kind of the extreme, we had that discussion on scenarios probably a year ago in the board meeting. These scenarios are the extreme, the low probability. The other range is the not so extreme, but I mean not the base case, but the 20-30% probability. For example, 3%, making 3% real is a lot better than these, but it's still way below target, and it's kind of now you're not talking sub 1% events, you're talking bigger probability. So in the kind of which should we be more concerned about, is it the China hard landing extreme case, or is it making 3% real?
Yeah. And my point is a simple one also, like if Hillary was president, the prospect of a Chinese hard landing would be X, and now that Trump's president, what hasn't changed?
Yeah,
you know, why not just incorporate that in here? And that's just a basic example, yeah. But maybe it went from 0.5% to 1%, but that's doubling. I just think those probability weightings are interesting, yeah. And it'd also be as Dr. Brown and I were just talking, it'd be a humbling exercise, but that's always good for the staff.
Mm-hmm. Compared to option pricing.
Yeah.
I totally agree. I'm just saying that once you talk probabilities, that there are scenarios that are not as extreme, higher probability. Sure, probably right. The customer should care, might care about them as much as these. Once you start putting them in. So definitely that's a helpful exercise.
So quickly, let's turn to page 36 and talk a little bit about illiquidity. Because that ties into our discussion of private equity. So what I want the board to kind of really focus on, I've walked Jeff through this a couple times, is you have three kind of tests that rein us in from an illiquidity perspective. The first one is just the actual illiquidity. This is the 90-day illiquidity of the overall endowment portfolios. We have to keep that below 70%. We're now at about 65%. So that is one of the governors on what we can do. Okay. The second governor is to the right. It's the unfunded commitments as a proportion of the net asset value of the endowments. That is a maximum of 30%. So that is another governor. You have these two tests. I think of them like a debt covenant. We have two debt covenants, right? We can't breach either one of them. The third is we have an absolute limit of 45% of the endowments can be in private equity. That's the policy limit. Those three limits constrain us. So you will not wake up one day and see us going over those. What can happen is that the markets can cause any one of these to be breached. We are managing to 40. So we are staying 500 bips below the absolute policy, and we believe 40% private equity, we can stay below these two. We believe the unfunded are actually going to come down, and we believe that we can stay below the 90-day illiquidity trigger. But those are the three tests you have that constrain us that we will constantly update you on and that we look at. So I just want to be really clear on how we're thinking about it and how we're managing to it. We're managing to a 40% number as a long-term number.
Mark, what kind of drawdown in our performance would cause us to hit the minimum liquidity line?
The 70, which is so
we're at 66.
Right, yeah. Yeah. So 70 we report to the risk committee.
What kind of drawdown? Let's just say
It's about, Uzi, is it 20%?
So we're getting we're closer than we want at 67%. It's probably around 15 to 20%. I think as the hedge fund book is selling down, we should settle more closer to the 65% line, and then the market change that will cause us to increase to 70 will be about the same market that would cause privates by themselves to go to 45.
So if the market dropped 15%, we hit our illiquidity zone, and our unfunded commitments were still here, mm-hmm. and we weren't getting any realizations mm-hmm. from the book, mm-hmm. Or the private equity book, what would we do?
Well, so if we hit the yellow line, we can't make another commitment without going to the risk committee.
Okay.
If we hit the red line, it's a full stop, and we have to present a plan to the board. That's the way the policy's written. You know, the reality is we're going to talk to you all about exactly what's going on. You know, and we're going to be very hesitant to make many new commitments. What we want to be really careful of is balancing liquidity versus missing the opportunity to be in a venture partner that it took us years to get access to, for example. Right? Those are the kind of trade-offs we have to make.
But the unfunded will continue to be there and be called, and the 70 could, even if we make zero commitments in the scenario that you said, we can grow from 70 to 75 pretty quick.
So just briefly, the last slide I want to spend any time on is page 38, which shows you the current tactical allocation relative to current policy. And I believe, is this 11:30, Uzi?
Yes.
Okay, so this is at November 30th. Where were we versus the policy on November 30th? Not the year-end policy, the actual policy at the time. So the snapshot is we're a little less than 5% over in private equity, and what we've given up for that private equity is public equity, commodities, and hedge funds. That's the relative risk trade we've made. So about half of the 5% in private equity that we're overweight is a public equity underweight. And what I would say to you is, on a long-term basis, private equity volatility and public equity volatility are roughly the same.
private equity returns in our portfolio over public equity indices has been about a 400% premium. So that taking from public equity and putting in private equity, you wouldn't want to do your whole portfolio in that, but that is a, I believe that is a good risk trade. I believe we've added return potential with not a lot of added risk. Taking down a little bit of hedge funds on the margin and putting in private equity is a little bit different risk trade. Okay, so that really means we have to perform because hedge funds, as we all know, is a shock absorber in down markets relative to equities. So that is a little bit more risk, and it's more risk and more return. So I just want you to understand we think about those individual trades. This is not a huge tactical change relative to policy, but it's not zero. And so we look at it versus current policy and where policy is at year end, and we want to be really transparent about those relative trade-offs we're making.
Mark, could you comment on the extent to which we should be thinking of anything in the private book, certainly private equity, as a tactical asset class? I mean, it seems like if you decided that that's not where you wanted to be, it would be very hard to want.
Well, it's illiquid, Keith. There's no question. So, right. Is it? We call our allocation relative to policy tactical. We can move money from hedge funds to public equity pretty quickly. When we move it into private equity, it's a little bit longer term. So when it's longer term, we think of that as being more strategic. But so I take your point. We are, as I mentioned to Kyle this morning, and I'll mention to the rest of the board, we are doing a study. We are talking to the relevant players in the market about what it would look like if we wanted to sell some of our book. Because one of the things we could do if we hit those limits is we could say, you know what, we don't want to go out of business in the private book. We want to keep making commitments. We can reduce the NAV and get under these liquidity targets by selling some of the book. What would that cost us? What do we think that trade looks like? So we want to have that analysis ready if we need it, either if markets take us there and we need to address it, or in the context of the policy portfolio discussions we're having with the board, if the decision is, you know what, we hear you at 40, we want you at 35. If that's the decision we jointly make, then we're going to have a plan to get to 35. So we're doing that work right now. So we'll have that fresh.
I would challenge the...
Cambridge Associates
has joined the conference.
I would challenge, or at least ask you to consider, that the 400 outperformance of private equity over public. If you're using global equities, I guess that's probably accurate. If you're using U.S. equities, that's not accurate. So I would at least challenge you to think about, is that premium going to stay at that kind of level? And also, because we give up liquidity when we do that, as we've been discussing, you might want to just put that into the equation that it's not a given that 400 basis point premium is what's going to be delivered, especially in light of what we just discussed where Uzi mentioned about the valuation levels being substantially higher now than what they were three to 5 years ago.
So we definitely don't think it's a given. We think we have to earn that illiquidity premium. We do think about it. That number I quoted you has been the historic, but we can break it both by...
Kevin Carlo
has joined the conference.
And their public market equivalent, U.S., global, we can do any one of those analyses, and we will. You know, I think it's our job to continue to reconvince you that the private equity book is a good portfolio for us, and we're willing to do that. Look, the geographic stuff hasn't changed much. The hedge book, we have not put on any new hedges, but you can see we've got a lot of our yen and Chinese currency exposure hedged. I will tell you, if you flip to page 43, the derivatives, we're still, our counterparties have net exposure to us, so that hasn't changed. I'll just commend your reading the ITF returns. What I can tell you is anecdotally, you can see the three-month returns through November. I can tell you anecdotally the ITF is now up 1.4% through January, and I think we'll have very good value add. And you can see what makes up the ITF portfolio on 46. It's much different than the endowment portfolio in terms of its weightings and what we're trying to accomplish there. I think it's been a great development for the institutions. They're getting a much bigger return than they did when they had this in cash. Only meaningful contract to update you on is we signed a contract with Burgess. Sissy, is that just an updated contract? Yeah, so we just had to sign a new contract. They're a service provider for us. So that's the funds update. I'm sorry that took a little longer, but I actually think that's a
great place for us to have spent
time. That's good. Okay, great. Let's we'll briefly recess for lunch. We will reconvene at, let's call it 1:25.
Sure. We can keep working after people get food if you want. It's up to you.
Fine. Let's just reconvene at 1:30. That's fine.
Okay.
We have plenty of time.